Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are once again distributed to many winds. We have even different time zones represented. I'm in Park City drinking whiskey, which is delicious, but not right now because I drank too much yesterday. So Radha's on the East Coast. Lauren's on the East Coast. Ladies, what are you drinking?
Well, I am in Western New York. I'm actually recording at my in-laws' house, who are kindly watching my children so I can do this. But I most critically am drinking Wegmans brand LaCroix, which is just
That's great. The best
of Western New York.
I am drinking one of the hard seltzers, the alcoholic seltzer, which just tastes like seltzer. And as a result, like, really? This is what we're doing these days? We just drink alcohol that doesn't taste like alcohol at all. It just tastes like plain seltzer, but pretty good.
I mean, I guess.
It's better than like the Zimas that we snuck when I was in high school or so.
Is it better? I kind of miss the Zimas, guys.
Really? This is my shocked face. That's amazing.
I am extra excited for this week because our guest is an economist. Guys,
Whoa.
We have an economist on. It's going to be so great.
We're going to have to like roll this in. This is going to get out of hand pretty fast, I'm afraid. Would you like to introduce our guest, Radha?
I would. So Tori Whiting is joining us. She is the J. Van Andel Trade Economist at Heritage and has been doing a ton of writing and also tweeting and also general public education and catching us all up on trade issues. And today she's
like
going to be
a full-time job right now because it is crazy pants out there for a trade person.
It's day and night, really. I mean, it's just like you can't really blink or, you know, it's totally different. So Tori's going to help us figure out what has been going on generally, but maybe like starting with the last 24 hours. But before that, because I almost forgot, we should do our bombshell questions.
Yay!
And thank God Lauren is back so she can help us do this correctly. Because last time Erin and I were at a little bit of a loss with them.
I think we'd learned them by now. I mean, it's August. We've had them since January, but apparently they did not get committed to a good folder in the brain housing group. So
look,
sorry about that.
Specialization, guys. It's efficient.
All right. I'll start with the first question then, which these don't go in a particular order because I don't remember them very well either for some reason. If you could pitch a show or series to Netflix, what would it be?
Oh my gosh, so this is the hardest one. But I'm a sucker for a good rom-com. And I feel like what Netflix has been doing with like Guernsey, Potato Peel Pie Society, and To All the Boys I Love have been so great lately. I miss the days of a good rom-com. So I'd be like, Netflix, bring me on all the rom-coms. I feel like nobody really writes books about that anymore.
No.
But, you know, 20 years ago, it was like rom-com every weekend, new at the movie theater.
There's actually an author whose name is Jasmine Guillory. I'm not saying her name right, but she writes some really good, amazing rom-coms for like people who like rom-coms, but are a little embarrassed by the fact that like rom-coms. So we'll put this in the show notes.
One of the many guilty pleasures.
Speaking of books, who is your literary or fictional hero?
Oh, this is a really tough one. But the first thing that came to mind is, I don't know if you guys remember, there's a series of books, but in the 1980s, there was a Canadian TV series on Anne of Green Gables. So they basically adapted the books to TV with Megan Follows. And I love Anne of Green Gables. And no matter what, it's always stuck with me. There's a moment in the movie where Anne is talking with her teacher. And the teacher says, every day is a new day with no mistakes in it yet. And that has just always stuck with me.
That's
and
delightful.
I love Anne because I think that she is strong, independent, and like she doesn't take any crap. And I love that. I love characters like that. And I think it's been one of those ones that stuck with me for most of my life.
Unsurprisingly, I love Anne of Green Gables. I bet Radha does. And I bet Erin
sure
has
do.
Never read a single one.
Not a single one. How'd you know?
I just know.
And I've seen all the versions of Anne. I even saw the reunion show, which I don't recommend people watch.
Netflix just series is awful.
Oh, really?
I know. It's like so dark. Anne of Green Gables isn't meant to be dark like that, guys.
No, not dark. Anyway. We don't need dark. It's like the new Little Women that's going to come out that's supposed to be darker. I'm like, why? Oh, it was plenty dark already.
I've also never read Little Women.
Me neither. Don't do that.
All right. What do you follow like a sport that is not a sport?
Oh man, big guilty pleasure here is all things Bachelor. It's awful. Nice. It's so bad. I make my fiance watch it with me. And don't let him tell you that he doesn't get into it, because he absolutely does. And we always have our favorites. So obviously we're watching Bachelor in Paradise right now. It's awful, but great.
I have not watched a single one of those out of the absolute fear that I would never leave my home again. I would just be
constantly
watching.
Your brain cells are saved.
Yep. All right, Aaron, your turn.
What is your favorite algorithm?
Oh, yes. So the first thing that came to mind was Instagram. I love Instagram's algorithm. It's better, I think, than any other social media.
In terms of serving up ads or just other accounts or
celebrities? Everything.
The Rob Lowe account. Sorry, can we talk about how Rob Lowe's son dunk on him on Instagram? It's the most amazing thing ever.
But like the ads, I don't know how many times I've had an ad pop up on Instagram and I'm like, oh, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. I'm going to buy it. And then I love it. Like they have this mini blender, this like handheld blender you can like make your protein shakes in.
Wow.
Bought it. Loved it. Right?
That's great.
It's like QVC, but for Instagram.
Right. I mean, it is literally QVC, but for the millennial Gen X, whatever set. So.
But it's cool stuff. Fantastic. Like Facebook always recommends like weird things.
Yep.
Instagram is on point.
Facebook thinks I need like 7 million bras. Like I'm good. Thanks.
Facebook thinks I need more clothes from Marine Layer. It's like the only ad I seem to ever get. So anyway, shall we talk about trade?
Yes. Rada, kick us off.
And maybe the place to start is, Tori, do you want to just catch us up on where we are with, you know, our trade war that is or isn't a good idea?
And yeah, absolutely. Know that you're recording it like 12:30 Eastern on Sunday,
right?
The 25th, because God knows what will happen in the 48 hours between when this comes out. Exactly. Proceed.
It has been a wild ride this weekend. I mean, it's been a wild year and a half or 2 years on trade, honestly. But what has happened recently is that the president announced, after China announced over the weekend their retaliation to the latest round of tariffs from the Trump administration. So we're supposed to have roughly $300 billion worth of goods that will have extra tariffs by December 15th. So they're coming in two different waves. Those were set to be at 10%. The president's increasing them to 15%. And then even more than that, all the tariffs that have been imposed so far on China, about $250 billion worth or so, are going to be bumped up from 25% to 30% on October 1st. So basically, it's more of the same policy that hasn't gotten us any results over the last year and a half.
I was going to ask, like, so $300 billion worth of goods, like, that's a lot of goods. How much of that is that of all the things that we get from China?
Yes. So at this point, come December 15th, we'll have new tariffs on pretty much everything we buy from China.
Great. That's awesome.
Yeah, pretty much everything. And what this latest round, what's been happening so far is that a lot of the tariffs have been on things that businesses buy. So they've been on intermediate goods. So people will say, well, it hasn't had much of an effect on the American people, because what's happening is the businesses are kind of trying to absorb those costs or disperse those costs throughout their production process and minimize the effects on consumers as much as possible. But at the same time, if you parse out on inflation numbers, and you pull out the things that have had tariffs imposed on them, inflation on those goods is actually much higher than the regular inflation rate. So I think that what we will see come the end of the year and over, you know, the beginning of 2020 is more of an impact directly on the pocketbooks of the American people.
She really does sound like you, Rada. Intermediate goods, inflation. I mean, wow, these economists are really something. We should get a few of those.
Yeah.
They might be able to tell us some things.
Well, and, you know, you talked a little bit about inflation, Tori, but maybe you could kind of break down for us, and then I want to dig in a little bit on sort of the actual policy side of this. But what do we think are the problems with, you know, the increased costs of tariffs, especially as they move to consumer goods from intermediate goods? And I should say, I'll just preface this by, Tori is totally on the trade taxes team here, in which that's what we call them, both because it's easier to spell and because it's more accurate.
Yes, yes. Hashtag tariffs or taxes. So the whole situation, there's twofold here in my mind. The first thing is that You know, the president is essentially imposing new taxes on the American people, on American businesses, entirely unchecked. It's a process that has some bureaucracy, some things that have to be proven, but for the most part, the president can do whatever he wants. And if you've ever read the Constitution, you know that Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution says that Congress has the power to regulate trade. So not only is this an issue where Congress has delegated a significant amount of authority to the president that's unchecked, but you're also having the president effectively impose taxes on the American people without the approval of the House of Representatives, which is where all tax and revenue and tax policy bills are supposed to start. And there have been some reports out there that I think the Tax Foundation came out with one that said that at this point, all of the benefits of tax reform have essentially been lost in the costs that have been incurred because of the trade war with China.
Oh, interesting. So just for my own edification, we've run up a significant amount of the debt and the deficit, but gotten very little stimulative impact on the economy because we've swamped it with tariffs with China. Yep. Did I get that right?
Look at you talking economic stuff.
And on top of that, add all of the new taxpayer dollars that are being spent on agricultural subsidies to try and buy off the farmers so that they aren't getting upset about losing market access in China because of retaliation. So it's just a whole web of really government-managed trade.
Yeah. I saw some other reports just recently, and we'll talk a little bit about this on the G7 topic next, but there's looks like there might be a deal with Japan coming down the pipe. Is that true? And it's sort of like if we had joined TPP, but we'll only get the deal with Japan. Is that a rough summation?
So what it looks like has happened is they've come to kind of an agreement in principle. So they've agreed to agree on a few things, mostly in the area of agriculture, industrial goods, and digital trade. So that is... It looks like it's parsing some things out of the original TPP, but it's kind of TPP light. Really, the likelihood of even a U.S.-Japan trade agreement getting done anytime in the near future is pretty limited. I wouldn't even say the current Congress will be considering any trade agreement whatsoever. That includes the USMCA. No matter how much the administration's trying to push the USMCA.
We call that USMACA around here, by the way. So.
There's a really good, somebody came out with a tweet a while back when they first came out with the title of the USMCA, and they did it to the tune of YMCA.
Yeah. Nice! That's great.
It was great.
So returning to the China conversation, I think that the president has directed us, or hereby ordered all of the companies to stop trading in China, too. Does that sound right?
Yeah,
so that happened this week.
There's been some peculiar tweeting from the president that's basically saying, hey, American businesses, you need to leave China. Now, fun fact, all these businesses are private companies that, you know, the president doesn't really control their purse strings. But there's also been some pretty concerning conversation going on about the president using IEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, to declare a national emergency and maybe try to coerce these companies or to maybe even create like an embargo on China. There's been some word about things like that. And if you remember, we heard a little bit about IEPA flare up between US and Mexico with the immigration crisis a while back. And there were some concerns there as well. As far as I know, IEPA has never been used to impose trade measures, like revolving around a trade spat or to impose tariffs.
I mean, I think, Tori, you're right on, like, the only way for the president to actually control businesses investing in China would be, or engaging in China, whatever, doing in intermediate production or investment there, would be to impose these IEPA standards. And if he does that, then we have kind of a whole bucket of worries there. And I think the flip side, if he doesn't do that and just continues to ratchet up tariffs, there's increasing concern kind of globally about the economic effects. So I think you and I had sort of emailed when chatting about this recent CBO report on the overall economic effects of tariffs. So kind of what are we thinking in terms of policy outlook and economic conditions for the U.S. economy as we head into both 2020 election cycle and sort of general softening. There was a lot of talk about this inverted yield curve, which we don't need to go into right now, but recession fears, are they crazy? Do we feel like tariffs are kind of, we've seen their impact and they're going to get worse? They're going to flatline?
I don't think the recession fears are crazy. I think that I never want to be in the business of predicting or not predicting a recession, right? Because everyone's always wrong. Nobody really knows when a recession's going to come. But I think that not only right now are there concerns, but I think there's been some underlying concerns in the overall economic numbers over the last several months that have had me questioning the health of the overall economy. So not only do we see 1.8% for the last quarter in terms of economic growth, which is very dismal, but we've been seeing underlying, even when the growth was above 2% last year, we've been seeing underlying questioning on private investment numbers being low and exports, imports decreasing, both decreasing, especially in the last 6 months. So I don't think that it's something that people should slough off. I think it's something to be taken seriously. And I don't think that the trade disputes are helping at all. What would help is if we could turn the trade situation around, be promoting free trade, and then have the administration get back to their pro-growth policies like tax reform and deregulation and all those great things. But it's definitely, it's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and maybe just kind of we'll wrap up here, but at the point we're at where we've got these ongoing escalating trade disputes with China and this kind of lingering USMCA and questions, it feels like I just had to call it USMCA just to keep us on brand. It feels like we could be doing more with European allies, and we have sort of outstanding trade issues there. So maybe we could wrap up by kind of things we should be looking for in other trade relationships, and in particular with Europe, in terms of kind of getting trade on the right foot or worrying about trade getting off further off track on the wrong foot.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have this big looming mid-October, while I'm on my honeymoon, this big looming deadline for the president to decide on auto tariffs, which is a major concern for most of our allies, Europe, Germany being part of that, Japan, Korea, also very worried about it. I wouldn't be surprised if there's some sort of side agreement between the U.S. and Japan on the side of this U.S.-Japan bilateral regarding autos, but that's definitely on the forefront. I think the big thing with our allies, though, is we need to be working with our allies vis-a-vis China instead of against our allies. So far, the president has done a lot of punishing U.S. allies in terms of imposing steel and aluminum tariffs and talking a big talk against Germany and their trade deficit and France and French wine. We need to be really working with these people, because if we can have the United States, Canada, Mexico, Japan, Korea, et cetera, all addressing the China issue together, I'm not talking about with tariffs, but through our international organizations like the WTO, that's a much more powerful way to address those issues head on. I don't think you see any movement with any of our other trading relationships until the U.S.-China situation is straightened out. I just think there's not a lot of latitude. There's not a lot of bandwidth. There's barely anything going on between U.S., Japan, and U.S., EU won't start till the U.K. figures out what's going on there, figures out, you know, their deal with the EU. So it's a lot of uncertainty. But I think what we could be doing as the United States is trying to minimize the uncertainty with these partners as much as possible as we're in the midst of this China issue.
And we'll talk a little bit more about this when we talk about G7. But I think, you know, from my vantage point, which is basically exactly what you're saying, Tori, you know, we have these concerns about with uncertainty with allies, but we've also been creating a lot of incentives for people to sort of skirt around dollar denominated trade and trade with the U.S. to kind of focus on other trading relationships. And that has economic and, frankly, political impacts at this point. And so I think there's a lot to watch there.
All right. Thank you, Tori. This has been great.
Thank you.
It's so nice to have Radha to have a trade friend.
I know. I know. It was so fun to have an economist on. We should do this more, guys.
Anytime.
We'll see. Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
Moving on to keeping up foreign relations, where shall we start? Shall we start? Let's continue on the trade front, Radha, since you have a full trade segment this week. What, you want to tell us a little bit about Korea and Japan?
Yeah, so they're having a little bit of a spat. It actually, you know, actually it's a really interesting combination of historical, political, and economic conditions coming together. So just to catch everyone up and kind of actually working backwards here. So the most notable piece that had gotten the national security world a little bit more concerned was the Korea pulling out of this intel sharing pact with Japan that had been brokered sort of in the last administration and was largely thought to be an important part of sort of security cooperation in the region and containment on a number of fronts, most notably related to North Korea. In part, Korea pulled out of that in response to some trade issues that they'd been having with Japan. So prior to that, Japan had actually passed some stricter control on exports in a couple of key areas that were relevant for Korea. They'd also downgraded Korea's trading status, so they weren't like in this preferred trading club with Japan, which had implications for their exports as well. And all of this has really been brewing since, folks might remember, the previous head of South Korea had to resign after being impeached. And so Mr. Moon, the current head of Korea, took over. And one of the key elements of this new administration in South Korea was dealing with some leftover agreements that had been brokered with Japan relating to grievances from World War II. So in particular, two big agreements, one relating to how women, air quotes, comfort women, the sort of sexual slavery and luring of many women, including largely a number of Korean women, to be sexually enslaved and deal with Japanese soldiers during World War II, as well as some impressing workers to do steel work both before and during the war. So there were some agreements set to have Japan pay reparations and in agreement to have South Korea stop kind of talking about it all the time from Japan's perspective. And Korea has essentially pulled out of both of those air quote final agreements on those in those areas.
Court ruling in Korea, right? There was a court ruling that said that that was in fact not the last and final word, and that there would still be an expectation of additional reparations for, I think, pain and suffering separate from the physical and economic hardships that were imposed at the time, right?
Correct. And the agreements themselves were actually not terribly popular in South Korea when they were happening. And there's, you know, there's still a considerable amount of hard feelings. So the upshot is that we have this deterioration in relationships that has happened both on the political and or security and economic fronts and sort of a conflation across these, so that the response to economic pullback from Japan has been in the security arena from South Korea, which I think is concerning both in and of itself in that the pact is useful and we think valuable, but also concerning in that this sort of blurring between economic and security worlds that the U.S. has been doing does seem to be kind of a condition that's catching in other places, which is not ideal.
And this has always been kind of a high wire act, right? I mean, this is the U.S. engagement in Northeast Asia is U.S., Japan, Korea. Japan and Korea are not historical allies, to say the least. Japan occupied Korea for 30 some years. And so this has been a diplomatic tightrope. But I think one of the things that a lot of analysts are seeing here is that in the absence of really strong and dependable U.S. engagement, you have, you know, not just historical frictions bubbling up, that does happen from time to time in the region, but there's no framework or process or, I don't know, for lack of a better term, leadership to kind of get people back, you know, on side to engage the bigger, you know, concerns in the region, you know, which would be North Korea and also China. So that's, I mean, I think kind of a good example or like a microcosm of the sorts of things that might emerge in the international system if the U.S. kind of continues on this America First pathway.
One of the other dynamics in this that I found to be interesting is that the South Korean progressives, of which President Moon is a part, has much more positive views on North Korea in many ways than it does on Japan. And that's not true universally across the board. But when you talked with the more liberal parties, more progressive parties about reunification, they have much more positive sentiments. When you talk to them about Japan, you're talking about a not potential adversary, but a rival, a frustration, an ongoing thorn in their side in a lot of ways that they do not feel has made sufficient redress against the harms done them from 1910 to 1950 or so. And that just the attitude was really striking from an American perspective who tends to view the North Koreans as obviously, you know, evil incarnate in many ways. They view them as another part of the country that's going to be reunified and is getting significantly better over time in a way that we don't talk a lot about in the United States context.
That's interesting. Well, obviously, we'll keep an eye on both the trade elements of this, but also the military, you know, security cooperation and intelligence sharing, both of which are fairly important to the region. If we want to shift gears a little, we've talked about Sudan several times on the podcast this summer. And for a rare bit of seemingly good news, there was a power sharing agreement signed in Sudan about a week ago. So folks may remember earlier in the year, there was a series of ongoing protests. There was a brutal crackdown against those protests the first week of June. And it really seemed like following this coup against Omar Bashir, that the military was consolidating power, and it might seem that the kind of democracy efforts in Sudan were for naught. There's still a slight risk of that, but the I guess sunshine does appear to be shining for a bit. There's a power sharing agreement between the Military Transitional Council and the Forces for Freedom and Change. There will be a kind of council of 5 civilians, 5 generals. They will elect or choose a chairman. Now, the first chairman is going to be from the military, and that chairman will be there for 21 months. That is maybe a little bit concerning. There's sort of a question about whether or not that military leader will relinquish power after those first 21 months. Also concerning is that one of Bashir's main deputies, Lieutenant General Degallo, who's in charge of the Rapid Support Forces, who first were engaged in this crackdown in June, but also were responsible for the Janjaweed activities in Darfur many years ago. He himself sits on the council, so it's not 11 Nelson Mandelas that have been selected from the Sudanese public. But I think from what I was reading, there certainly seems a better pathway forward. And it's a pathway forward. And there's some opportunities for continued prosecution of Bashir at the domestic level, not at the International Criminal Court, and maybe the potential for some ongoing democratic and anti-corruption reforms. So anyway, that was a bit of bright news that I thought was nice to share.
Not to be like overly Pollyanna-ish, but it does seem like, Aaron, in some of the sort of limitations you've highlighted, which I think are real things to watch, like having the military be the first in charge and sort of keeping some lingering guys with very difficult paths. It also kind of indicates that this is actually a kind of real thing that, you know, they came to an agreement that's not perfect, but does seem to actually seem feasible and is plausibly enforceable and will happen over time. And so I think there is some hope that in some ways, warts and all, this is a path forward that the Sudanese could reasonably be expected to follow. And if so, that'd be a, you know, pretty tremendous way to transition to civilian control.
Yeah, the only other points I'd add is folks may remember we talked about this agreement about a month and a half ago that has been flesh out and now finally agreed on and more fully. Some other elements of it that are positive is the likely selection of a civilian prime minister who is an economist who's worked in the international system for some time and is generally respected. He will be kind of in charge of the bureaucracy per se, as well as the commitment to the ultimate elections that will be dominated by the protest movement party or the party that is emerging from the protest movement. And in some ways, like, folks tend to want to push for elections in these sort of situations fairly soon. I think a lot of folks who have experience in this area have seen if you push for elections too soon without the consolidation of political parties who have the strength to fight against the prior electoral parties or the militarized parties, you're not going to particularly appreciate the results in some ways. This gives them time, theoretically, to develop among civil society a stronger democratic party structure that gives the civilians more representation or stronger representation in the upcoming government.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And will be interesting to watch. So we'll continue to keep that kind of in our show rotation. Speaking of rotation, it is France's turn to host the G7. And I sent a note out, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours ago asking folks to like pick their favorite thing from the G7 thus far. As I know, it is now 1 o'clock on the East Coast on Sunday. What thus far have you guys seen from the G7?
So my favorite thing, and this is really sad, is that they decided not to have an agreed on communique. So if folks have ever paid attention to G7s or G20s before, which you probably haven't, because let's face it, why? There's always an agreed on communique that comes out at the end. It says, here are all the sort of vague things that we talk about and agree on. They decided not to do one this year because they knew that the United States would not agree to any that mentioned the Paris deal or climate change at all. So why bother making a stink out of it? If you folks will remember at the last one, President Trump left early because he was so pissed about this ongoing negotiation. President Macron, I guess, sort of interestingly decided, like, you know what, that's not worth a fight. Let's save our energy for negotiation over things that we might actually come to some progress on. And he got rid of the communique. Also fascinatingly saying that he acknowledged most people don't read these and they are not terribly important. So I guess I admire the hope that there's potential for progress on issues without the, like, the show of the communique, which seems to be most of what all the Sherpas who work on these issues do year round.
So first of all, I had the communique on my, like, list of favorite things. And I was like, well, okay. But my number one thing on the list is Boris Johnson, who's Trump's version of a BFF, I guess, suggesting that maybe the U.S. was being, like, a little bit crazy and pushing too far on China. If we could just dial down the tension. So I feel like when you've gotten to the point that Boris Johnson is telling you to simmer down, like, maybe it's time to just take a deep breath, like, do some meditation, see where you get. So that's been my most favorite moment this far. I will just say, I heard rumors that our president Trump also suggested that he might like to invite President Putin next time, you know, just because that's his real BFF. And so I do wish that there was a picture of facial expressions when that was tossed across the transom.
Aaron, I hope you're going to raise second thoughts.
Well, so my first thought was, of course, was Donald and Boris. And Trump came out and said, we're going to do a very big trade deal, bigger than we've ever had with the UK, which made me wonder, like, about the nature of prior trade deals with the United Kingdom. But then I was scrolling through Twitter, and it turns out that Emmanuel Macron invited the foreign minister of Iran.
Yeah, that was pretty great.
Tell anybody until dinner last night.
Awkward moves.
And I don't know, that just seems like kind of a big deal. And that is now my front runner for best tidbit out of the G7. So I guess we'll see what else happens.
I did like, as a closing part of the G7, a reporter asked President Trump if he had any second thoughts about ongoing tensions with China.
Oh, right. And
his response was like, why not? Yes, of course. And the reporter was like, so your second thoughts? He's like, I have second thoughts on everything. Like, okay, that's great.
But his second thought was that he wished he had made the tariffs higher.
Yeah.
The press secretary clarified that this morning.
It's cool.
That's great.
Cool.
So
cool.
As a reminder about, like, what we would like our G7 leaders to be talking about, we're going to bring back our This Is Still a Thing segment, which is an ongoing reminder of, like, critical crises that we just, for whatever reason, don't talk about as often as we should. And This Is Still a Thing this week is climate change.
Yeah, you know, niche issue, really.
Right. So there are, like, lots. I guess one of the reasons we kind of decided to come back to this briefly this week is that there were lots of different climate stories in the news. We'll get to Greenland. Don't worry. We'll totally talk about Greenland. But I think, for me, one of the pieces that caught my eye, and it's because it's a super nerdy measurement story, was this article talking about how it turns out the oceans have actually warmed more than we originally realized. And that's because our older efforts at taking measurements of ocean temperature were fairly flawed or somewhat rudimentary. And so once they did all the kind of calculations and recorrections, they determined that the ocean, in fact, has been warming faster. And so that on itself is sort of one data point. But the article, which is part of a broader book, and I don't know if I buy all of the argument of the broader book, but it's an interesting perspective, is that a lot of climate science is really committed to what they talk about as univocality, so speaking with one voice. And so a lot of times on these certain questions on whether or not temperatures are rising or what's going on with certain amounts of ice coverage, for example, they can get agreement on the low end, but there's a handful of folks who basically say that the loss or the temperature increase is much, much, much higher, but they can't get agreement on that outlier. So they do a lot of kind of lowest common denominator kind of assessments, because that's where they can get consensus, which is really important when you're trying to get a scientific community to feed information to a policy community who is quite divided on, you know, what to do about all of this. But the risk has maybe been that in being conservative with those estimates and sort of going toward the lower end on topics like sea level rise, ocean temperatures, ice coverage, that we've actually missed how bad the shifts are currently occurring, and also how quickly they may change going forward. And I think that's part of the news cycle that I've kind of paid the most attention to, which is that it's not that climate change is coming, it's that it's here, and the feedback loops are happening way more intensely than maybe the models even suggested a few years ago.
Yeah, and probably the Amazon like burning down isn't going to totally help that.
Yeah, so that's the other thing that caught everybody's attention this week, right? 80,000 something fires in the Amazon and the Brazilian portion of the Amazon. Is that right?
And it's worth remembering that there are many more fires going on around the world. And the fires in Brazil are actually the, I think, third largest that are going on. Obviously important because it's in the Amazon and that contributes to the ecosystem. But the stuff else around the world is maybe, I was about to say maybe not so hot. Wow. That's a really wow. bad pun.
That would be bad.
Jeez.
The Amazon ones also seem to be linked to sort of the Brazilian government sort of open willingness to allow deforestation and sort of ongoing clearing in the Amazonian regions, which I think increase the risk and also the scale and escalations of the fires.
They're not like accidental forest fires or natural fires for the most part.
Right. The other thing that was shocking no one that caught my attention this week was, you know, there have been sort of a range of different estimates over time coming out on the impacts of climate change. And I think sort of to Aaron's point that a lot of the scientific community has accepted that climate change is here and it's happening more quickly than folks had realized, and that there are like sort of pretty tangible effects to that. And so there was a recent NBER, National Bureau of Economic Research working paper that actually just came out reestimating the GDP effects of climate change at the new accelerated rates that look to be around 7% of GDP worldwide, a little bit more than that, with just as a point of reference, if emissions had been held at the Paris Accord levels, right? So accepting still some climate change, the estimates had been about a 1% to 2% GDP loss, which is, to be clear, still not nothing.
Right. And that, of course, still won't be felt evenly across states right. or across the international system, right?
Exactly. And actually, to Aaron's point, the error bars on the 7% for those seeking to look at them are wide, and the upper ends are not comforting numbers. So the paper itself is a little bit technical, but I'll put in the show notes a Washington Post article covering the paper and what's in it. And I think it's actually worth kind of understanding both the economic effects and, as Aaron is saying, where they'll be concentrated, because that's not going to be great.
My final contribution on This Is Still a Thing is a really depressing series of threads I read on a online mommy board, which I don't usually read. I should swear up and down I don't. But this particular one caught my eye because it was about how do you raise your kids in an era where climate change is upon us. And this is particular discussion talks about like the fact that people are frustrated by paper straws and the using recyclable or paper bags and things like that. When the realization, and also the Impossible Burger is where it started, with the realization that making these binary choices are actually not doing a whole lot for climate change overall. They do a little bit, but you should really be thinking about more revolutionary change in terms of like, should you be shopping extremely differently so you don't have to bring home groceries all at once? Should you be buying iced coffees at all? Or should you only be filling them in your own personal jar so that you're not producing more plastic anytime you purchase something? And how do you raise kids in an era where they are going to experience all these changes over the next 10, 20 years drastically, such that they're prepared for that and they're start making those choices more naturally than we did?
And that gets to a broader question of whether, you know, individual decisions are how they contribute in an era of you know, pretty profound climate change versus actual structural changes, right? And I think, I hope we're getting to a policy place. The Democratic Party has decided not to do a climate change debate, for example, which is kind of a bummer for a variety of reasons. But these are all excellent questions. I think the climate debate is one of those places where, you know, there's the politics of it are one thing, the science of it is something else. The intersection of that is its whole own Frankenstein. And then we have, as we've noted, both, you know, individual family concerns that arise from that and great big questions about global GDP. So a little something for everyone, except if you wanted good news. Oh, I promised we'd talk about Greenland, and we'll use that to segue to White House mayhem. So something else that caught people's eye a few weeks ago was this massive melt-off in Greenland. We think they lost 55 billion tons of ice melted, including the largest single loss since 1950, similar to a 2012 event. These are supposed to happen roughly every 250 years, not every seven. So that's kind of a bummer. But also a bummer is that apparently President Trump would like to buy Greenland, but the Danes said, no thanks. And then he canceled a trip there. What the hell? Anyone? Beeler? Who can explain this to me?
My favorite part about this, and Radha will have more substantive things to say, is that Senator Tom Cotton came forward ultimately after this whole thing went down and said this was his idea. So normally
of course it was.
You come forward with a statement like that and say like, oh, this is my idea, when it's an actually good idea or where it gets positive attention or where, you know, somebody might take your side in some way. For reasons surpassing understanding, he came forward and said, this is my idea, after the entire universe shat upon it profusely.
Thanks, Tom.
Sigh. So a serious and a not serious thing. So one is, on the day that this was emerging, I sort of saw it in passing on Twitter, but was tied up with family things and really truly thought this was a joke about something else that the president had done. But like, it's like the president suggested by, I did not appreciate that it was the president suggesting we buy Greenland, like for reals. And so
how the people at the Onion go to work every day anymore. Like, I mean, literally, what is there left to do? Okay, we have one other topic in White House mayhem that I'm going to blast through because I have very important topics in pop culture to discuss with you all. So also in the news this week was renewed speculation that the Secretary of State might run for Senate. And I have to say, if we had a segment called Extremely My Shit, this would have to be at the top of my list because he might run for Senate from the great state of Kansas. So Secretary Pompeo, of course, was a representative from Kansas. I think it's important to note that he's not from there. He's from California. He's not one of us. He's just an interloper. But this week, he went to New York to meet with a series of donors, including Ronald Lauder and the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, headed, of course, by people like Steve Forbes and Arthur Laffer. There's basically no reason for the Secretary of State to meet with those individuals, but a prospective Senate candidate might want to meet with Republican donors. He's also giving a talk at K-State in September, and he's kept up a pretty active travel schedule to the state of Kansas, which, again, you don't need to do when you're Secretary of State. He has until June 1st to file, which basically means there can be infinite speculation about what he may or may not do. And the reason there's a lot of speculation is because Mitch McConnell desperately wants him to move back to Kansas and run for Senate because the alternative is that Kris Kobach would run for Senate from the state of Kansas. And they think that he would lose to, well, basically any Democrat, but in particular, Kathleen Sebelius, who's a former governor. I don't know if she's going to run. That seems to also be sort of up in the air, but it is a whole whirlwind of Kansas politics that, for whatever weird reason, also involves the Secretary of State. So stay tuned. You know that I'll have my finger on the pulse of all of this exciting stuff.
All right, pop culture. We're so excited. Pop culture.
Oh my God. So we know you all want to talk about Star Wars, and we're going to make you wait until Lauren and I first talk about Logan Eccles and Veronica Mars. Spoilers. If you haven't watched, tune out now.
Okay. For those that don't know, Veronica Mars released a kind of like mini season four, I think 8 episodes that came out. And spoiler, Logan dies at the last part of the last episode.
But also has a very weird career in the Navy. Okay, seriously, anybody who works in Hollywood, please hire us, especially if you're going to have Logan Eccles on, to be your military advisors, because we could have given him a career that made a lot more sense. And we certainly could have fixed that dress whites issue in the movie from before, which maybe we should not even discuss.
The dress whites issue in the movie was super weird. Also, he was a pilot. How in God's name did Logan Eccles, who I'm not sure finished college, he was arrested a gajillion times. He was a drug addict. God even knows. I think he murdered people. He became a Navy pilot. Like, doesn't the Navy have enough
problems? That just makes sense. I mean, I can't decide which makes more sense, that he became a pilot or that he later became a SEAL. I mean, that's kind of, you know, neither here nor there. But yeah, it's a very weird. Overall, I thought for folks who take the show quite seriously, Pop Culture Happy Hour did a great breakdown of the challenges of Rob Thomas's noir vision. And there's actually some really interesting episodes on Logan and Veronica's relationship and how Logan is actually trying to not be such a hothead and not be such a bad boy and to get over his drug addiction. And Veronica kind of finds that boring and how that makes things fraught sometimes. Anyway. Veronica Mars, happy to talk about that with anyone, anytime. But in the interest of our listenership, we'll move on to the big, big news of the last few days. Radha, do you know what it is? Do you even know what we're going to talk about?
I have no idea, actually. I know that it was raised as a topic in our planning discussion. And
Ewan McGregor, who I think you know who Ewan McGregor is.
I saw Aaron tweet about this.
All right. He's coming back as Obi-Wan Kenobi. And I love Ewan McGregor so much.
So much. So... yes, he's coming back, Radha.
He's not dead.
Here to help folks who don't like Star Wars. You're welcome.
Okay, so if you are roughly my age, then you waited your entire childhood for the prequels to come out. And when the prequels came out in the late 1990s, you were devastated because they were terrible, except for one very, very small thing. And that was Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan Kenobi, mm-hmm. who was amazing and hot and funny and perfect. And we all said to ourselves, well, maybe we'll get a Ewan McGregor Obi-Wan Kenobi movie or series or something. And we didn't, and we didn't, and we didn't until now. Oh, I am so excited. It's going to be a TV show, I think, on the new Disney Plus, which I've got to find a way to like get my brother to subscribe to so I can steal his login. Also, they released a trailer for The Mandalorian, yep. which is the first series that we're going to get.
And it has Werner Herzog in it.
Yeah.
Oh my seriously. God.
I can't believe Werner Herzog is in a Star Wars show, but apparently Disney spent a shit ton of money on this series, which means you're all going to have to subscribe. We also have some movie art for the final main Star Wars movie, Episode 9. Rey
really
maybe
final?
Has a red lightsaber at some point.
Right. And also, we want to shout out to Adam Serwer for his theory about who Rey is. I'm not going to tell you right now, but you should just Google Adam Serwer Rey theory on Twitter. You'll find it, and it's totally worth it.
Yeah, we've talked about that before.
Right. We have.
I'm gonna throw Adam a party if it turns out that's true. Yep. That's basically where I'm at with this.
I'm probably not going to Google that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all right. But you should come to the party.
I will absolutely come to the party. I'm happy to drink Star Wars themed cocktails. How's that?
I don't know about that. Like, so I guess, in LA, I need to go to the Star Wars Disneyland place
yep.
before I come back to Washington. And you can actually order the blue milk from Tatooine, which I'm like, why would I do that? That does not sound like something that I actually
want. No, I more meant tasty cocktails that you just give weird names from like planets or light.
Yeah, I've got like Star Wars glasses at home. I'll pour you a glass of rosé. It'll be delicious.
There you Perfect. Go.
So anyway, lots of amazing Star Wars-ness. I actually cannot convey how excited I am about Ewan McGregor in an Obi-Wan Kenobi series. He could just do nothing. He could just like screw around Tatooine for 20 years and I would totally watch that.
You know what would be great? If you created the meme of Nick Offerman drinking the whiskey, but just with Obi-Wan drinking blue milk, staring at a screen. Amazing.
And with that, our fellow listeners, we will bid you adieu. Until next time, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.